50. Whispering Gallery. Milgram woke in a narrow bed beneath a single flannel sheet printed with trout flies, partial riverscapes, and the repeated image of an angler casting. The pillowcase was made of matching material. On the wall opposite the foot of the bed was a large poster of an American eagle's head, depicted against the billowing folds of Old Glory. He seemed to have gotten undressed for bed, although he didn't remember doing it. He looked at the poster behind glass in a plain gold plastic frame. He'd never seen anything quite like it. It had a soft, worryingly pornographic quality, as though a Vaseline lens had been involved, though he supposed they no longer really did that, Vaselining lenses. Likely the whole thing had been executed on a monitor. The eagle's eye, though, was hyper-realist, bright and beady, as if rendered to fix on the viewer's forehead. He thought a slogan would have helped, somehow, some nudge in a specific patriotic direction. Just these sinuous waves of stripes, though, a few stars up in one corner, and the raked and angular head of this really rather murderous-looking bird of prey, was too much on its own, too purely iconic. He thought of the peculiar phoenix-like creature on the front door, downstairs. But then he remembered eating pizza that Brown had ordered in the kitchen, downstairs. Pepperoni and three cheeses. And the fridge, which had contained a six-pack of very cold Pepsi and nothing else. He remembered feeling the smooth white circles of the heating elements on the range, something he'd not seen before. Brown had taken his pizza into a sort of study, along with a glass and a bottle of whiskey. Milgram had never seen Brown drink before. Then he'd heard Brown on the phone, through the closed door, but hadn't been able to make anything of it. And then, he guessed, he treated himself to another rise. Sometimes, he observed now, sitting on the edge of the bed in his underwear, a little too much had a way of clearing the air the morning after. He looked up and encountered the eagle's gun muzzle eye. Looking quickly away, he rose, surveyed the room, and began to search it, quietly and with an efficiency born of practice. It had obviously been decorated to be a boy's room, and in the style of the rest of the house, though perhaps with a bit less effort. Less Ralph Lauren than some diffusion line. He hadn't yet seen a single actual antique, aside from the eagle outside, which might even be original to the house. The furnishings were faux old, and that rather half-hearted, more likely made in India or China than North Carolina. For that matter, he thought, noting the room's empty inbuilt bookcase, he hadn't seen a single book. He carefully, quietly opened each drawer in the small bureau. All empty, aside from the bottom one, which contained a wire coat hanger clad in tissue, printed with the name and address of a dry cleaner in Bethesda, and two pins. He knelt on the carpet and peered under the bureau. Nothing. The small, vaguely colonial desk, finished, like the bureau, in rather robotically distressed blue paint, offered nothing more, other than a dead fly and a black ballpoint pen marked Property of U.S. Government in white. Milgram tucked the pen into the elastic waistband of his underwear, having at that point no pockets, and carefully opened what he took, correctly, to be a closet door. The hinges squeaked with disuse. Empty coat hangers rattled on a hook. The closet proved to contain nothing but more coat hangers, on one of which hung a small navy blazer with an elaborately gold-embroidered crest. Milgram went through its pockets, finding a wadded Kleenex and a stub of chalk. The boy's jacket and the piece of chalk saddened him. He didn't like thinking of this as a child's room. Perhaps there had been other things here once, books and toys, but somehow it didn't seem like it. The room suggested a difficult childhood, perhaps not too different from the one Milgram itself had had. He left the closet, closing the door, and went to the blue, ladder-backed chair on which his clothes had been draped. Forgetting the U.S. government pen, he jabbed himself with it as he was putting on his pants. Dressed, he approached the drawn striped drapes of the room's single window. Positioning himself so he could move the outer edge of one drape as minimally as possible, he discovered what he took to be N Street on what appeared to be an overcast day. But his angle down also revealed the right front fender of a parked car, black and highly polished. A large car, to judge by what he could see of its fender. He put on the Paul Stewart coat, discovering his book in its pocket, clipped the government pen into the inside pocket, and tried the room's door, finding it unlocked. A paneled, carpeted hallway, illuminated now by a skylight. He looked over a banister and down two flights to the softly gleaming gray marble of the hallway they'd entered yesterday evening. One of those central but minimal stairwell shafts encountered in houses of this age, very long and narrow, running back to front. Beside his ear, a spoon rattled against china. He spun, starting violently. "I appreciate that," an invisible brown said, with an uncharacteristic note of gratitude. The hallway was empty. "I understand what you have to work with," said a voice Milgram had never heard before, the speaker equally close, equally invisible. "You're using the best men available to you and finding them lacking. We see that all too often. I'm disappointed, of course, that you weren't able to apprehend him. In the light of your previous lack of success, I think it would have been wise to arrange to try to photograph him, don't you? To be prepared to photograph him, in any case, in the event he escaped again." The man had a lawyer's cadence, Milgram thought. He spoke slowly and clearly, and as though he took it for granted that he'd be paid attention to. "Yes, sir," said Brown. "Then we might at least have a chance to learn who he is." "Yes." Eyes wide, gripping the banister rail as though it were the railing of a ship in a storm, Milgram stared down at the distant, narrow slice of marble floor, tasting his own blood. He'd bitten the inside of his cheek when that spoon had rattled against that coffee cup. Brown's breakfast conversation was being reflected off that marble floor, he guessed, or being sucked up this slit of federal stairwell, or both. Had children stood here 100 years ago, he wondered, suppressing giggles at some other conversation? "You say the information intended for him indicates that he still has no tracking ability, hence no knowledge of whereabouts or ability to predict destination." "Whoever he has working on it," Brown said, "doesn't seem to be getting the job done." "And our friends," the other said, "are they able to determine, when they go over this material, what it is exactly that's being so unsuccessfully searched for?" "The assessment's handled by someone who has no knowledge of any of this. It's just information to him, and he analyzes classified data constantly."
"Government?"
"Telco," Brown said. "You know who handles the decryption. They never look at the product, and our analyst has every reason to pay as little attention as possible to what this might actually be about. I've made sure of that."
"Good. That was my understanding."
Cutlery rattled loudly on a plate, so seemingly close that Milgram winced.
"So," the other man said, "are we in a position to bring things home?"
"I believe we are."
"So the shipment finally comes to port, after all this time."
"But not in Conus," Brown said.
"Conus?"
Milgram blinked, terrified for an instant that this entire conversation might all be some unprecedented aural hallucination.
"No," agreed the other. "Not yet on American soil."
"Conus," thought Milgram, in 4th of July capitals. "Continental United States.
And what are the current odds of it being opened for inspection?"
the man asked.
"Extremely unlikely," Brown said. "Slightly more likely to have a gamma scan, but the contents and packing look fine that way. We actually had it gammaed ourselves in a previous port of call to see how it reads."
"Yes," said the other. "I saw those."
"You agree, then?" asked Brown.
"I do," said the other. "What steps are being taken in your absence in New York?"
Brown took a moment to answer.
"I sent a team to the IF's room for fingerprints and to recover the surveillance device. They found the door open and everything under a coat of fresh latex paint, even the light bulb. no fingerprints, and there were none on the iPod, of course. The unit was where I left it, under a coat rack, but they dumped that outside.
They didn't find it.
If they did find it, they might avoid doing anything to indicate that.
Are you any closer to understanding who they are?
They're one of the smallest organized crime families operating in the United States. Maybe literally a family. Illegal facilitators, mainly smuggling. But a kind of boutique operation, very pricey. Mara Salvatrucha looks like the UPS in comparison. They're Cuban Chinese, and they're probably all illegals.
Can't you get ICE to roll them up for you?
We have to find them first. We found the kid and followed him home in the course of trying to find the subject. We found him, to the extent that we ever did, from what you told us about the subject. The rest of them are like ghosts.
Milgram found that he knew Brown well enough now to hear the edge of a certain craziness in his voice. He wondered if the other man did.
Ghosts?
The other man's tone was absolutely neutral.
The problem, Brown said, is that they've been trained, really trained. Some kind of intelligence background in Cuba. I'd need that professional a team, and it hasn't happened, has it?
No, said the other. But as you yourself once said, they aren't really our problem. He is our problem. But if he knows what we're doing, we now know that he doesn't know when or where. Perhaps later we can steer adequate professionalism in the direction of your facilitators, when it has nothing to do with us, of course. And we'll certainly have to find out who our man is and do something about him.
China rattled on a table as someone stood. Milgram released the banister and made it back into his room in two long, agonized, exaggeratedly careful steps. He closed the door with utmost care, took off his coat, draped it over the chair, removed his shoes, and got under the angling-themed sheet, pulling it up beneath his chin. He closed his eyes and lay perfectly still. He heard the front door close. A moment later, he heard an engine start and a car pull away. After an indeterminate period of time, he heard Brown open his door.
"Wake up," Brown said.
Milgram opened his eyes. Brown stepped to the bed and tore the sheet away.
"How the fuck can you sleep in your clothes that way?"
"I fell asleep," Milgram said.
"Bathroom's down the hall. There's a robe there and a garbage bag. Put everything you're wearing in the garbage bag. Shower, shave, put on the robe, and come down to the kitchen for a haircut."
"You give haircuts?" Milgram asked, amazed.
"The housekeeper's here. He'll give you a haircut and measure you for some clothes. And if I catch you sleeping in them, you'll regret it."
Brown turned on his heel and left the room. Milgram lay there, looking at the ceiling. Then he got up, got his toiletries out of his coat, and went to take his shower.